Welcome to the 124th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 43 years to the day that news broke of Kerry Packer's World Series cricket. The establishment was furious. Papers of the day described the cricketers as pirates. Welcome to the podcast that would love to be described as pirates.
So we're recording this in the middle of May and the seasons have changed, which means that I think this is the first podcast of the year which we have recorded with Andy, it being your morning in London and my evening in Sydney. Usually it's the other way around and I'm up at, you know, 6 a.m. with a cup of coffee. You've got a cup of coffee in your hand?
Cup of tea, third of the morning, yeah.
Third cup of tea of the morning. We're in for some podcasting genius. Today we are talking about some of the things that have kept us amused in the cricket world over the last couple of weeks. And it really feels like there's a lot going on in the cricket world at the moment, despite the fact that there's kind of no cricket going on. Andy's going to be taking us back to Power Cricket in Cardiff. I'm intrigued as you are. And we've been watching the first episodes of The Test, the new Amazon documentary about the Australian team over the last few years. So, Andy, what have you been finding to get excited about?
Well, I've missed cricket an awful lot during lockdown. I think I've realised not only how much I miss watching it, but also just how much I love having it as kind of a rhythm in my life. You know, having it in the scores to follow, keeping up on all the matches going on, both in the county world and beyond. But I've actually been quite slow to listen to or watch the various replays that people have been putting on to kind of help people through lockdown. I think partly because of a sense that it's just not the same, but also perhaps because of a fear that it would just leave me missing the real thing even more. But yesterday I did tune in to the BBC's replay of the 2005 Ashes Test at Edgbaston. My timing was perfect. Ashley Giles had just dismissed Ricky Ponting and Henry Blofeld was busy comparing Giles' approach to the wicket to that of a wheelie bin. He was very quick to reassure viewers that he knew Giles was absolutely fine with that description. And I was pleased I did tune in because it was great fun. And it was a reminder of just what a wonderful time machine cricket commentary, or perhaps sports commentary more broadly, can be. You may not have had that jeopardy, you know, will Kasparovic do it, etc. But it still takes you right back into the midst of that heady summer.
So this was the TMS commentary. This was just the audio that you were listening to.
Absolutely, yeah. So they've picked out, I guess, a few sort of classic games and are playing them sort of on some form of rotation.
And what do you this may sound like a niche question, but what do you do when you're listening to reruns of cricket games from the past? Because you're right, there's not that kind of jeopardy of being there ball by ball, needing to focus, needing to kind of, because when I'm listening to a game live, I'm generally pacing up and down, you know, desperate to hear what the next ball's going to bring. Did you not find yourself just getting really distracted as you sat there listening to a game on rerun, as it were, when you knew what the outcome was going to be?
So I guess it was quite typical for when I normally listen to cricket commentary and that I was doing something else. So I was doing some not particularly thrilling kind of work admin, and this was sort of in the background. So you have that lovely sense that I think you often get with cricket commentary where you're sort of drifting in and out.
And it provides a bit of a structure as well, a bit of a structure over time when you're listening to a game as it unfolds.
It does. And you know, you can have that wonderful thing with a test match where I think it's always harder with a limited overs game, where actually you can very much pick up the ebbs and flows of a game without necessarily being engaged with every ball. I think what I found, it was also very interesting to realise what you'd forgotten. So this is obviously an iconic test match. I mean, some people would argue the greatest ever. But I'd forgotten, for example, the Michael Vaughan run out of Damian Martin on the second day, another really key moment in this. So it's quite fun from that perspective to be reminded. But it is also as much about conjuring the mood. I think that was what I was surprised by. I think listening to it, it was quite funny how quickly you felt you were back in 2005.
And did you remember that? Did you remember the moments when you'd been listening to it originally? Because I know in my head certain places where I watched that series. Did it take you personally back to some of those?
Yeah, I think it takes you back to places, and also I think, frankly, it takes you back to a stage in life. You know, yeah. And that point, I was sort of, I was a schoolboy, so I think there's that side of it as well, and I think that's, I guess, one of the joys of sort of sports nostalgia and sort of sports reminiscences, that you have that ability to be transported back to a time and a phase as much as a place.
Like you, I've been, you know, finding ways to engage with cricket at a time when cricket isn't happening. And something over the last couple of weeks for me has been quite unexpected, which is finding some new cricket poetry. So The Guardian have been running a series of poems recommended to comfort us during isolation. And a couple of weeks ago, the poet Carolan Duffy recommended a poem by Kit Wright, which is a poet and a poem that I hadn't come across before. It's called The Roller in the Woods. And it's about really discovering an old, out-of-use cricket ground, and that ground being sort of redolent with memory of playing village cricket and, you know, encounters on the cricket pitch. And it's a beautiful combination of the cut and thrust of cricket, of any cricket game, together with that romanticisation. Is that even a word? I think I just made that up, didn't I? Anyway, let's go with it. The romanticisation of the village green, this idea of you know, the cricket pitch surrounded by beautiful bucolic nature. There's this wonderful verse in the middle. I think this might be the first time that we've read poetry on Reverse Rep Radio, so here we go. There's this wonderful verse in the middle. Foaming hawthorn and rhododendron have colonized the field edge, spreading through copper beech and flowering chestnut and adventitious saplings. Where is the camaraderie of the side I played for so often here? Their thunderous blows and heroical overs, the days that flowed with sun and wind, stalemates in dismal drizzle, and the finger of death uplifted in the dusk. And I thought, what's beautiful about this poem is clearly it's escapism, and the cynic would say that it was overly romantic. But I think one thing that we're discovering at the moment is that the game of cricket exists so much in the imagination and the memory. And whilst we've got, you know, YouTube and TMS as reruns, as you've just described, to remind us of past games, we've also all spent those moments in our mind's eye lying, revisiting, you know, the great overs we've bowled. I can count mine on one hand, and the great innings we've had, I can count mine on one finger. And I think this poem is just a beautiful testament to the idea of cricket as something that can exist in our imagination and in our mind's eye, which I think is really poignant at the moment, particularly.
I think what's wonderful about it is that connection between the game and the place. And I think we've always known, I think, as cricket fans, that the connection perhaps cricketers have with where they play is perhaps stronger than in some other sports. I mean, I think you know, footballers don't perhaps feel the same way about a pitch in the way a cricketer may feel about the ground. And I think it really conjures for me that sense. I always think of that kind of last game in September in the UK, that last beer you have, and you look out, and by that point you've got the leaves falling onto the pitch, and you just have that kind of sort of, you know, beautiful sense of the seasons moving on and you know, on to winter, but also that very sad sense, you know, the pitch that you play on, the ground that you play on, is kind of leaving summer behind. And no, it's a wonderful poem. And I think when you say, I'm sure you're right that a cruel critic could say, you know, is this slightly over romanticized? I think now feels like a perfectly acceptable time for us all to be romanticizing.
From the archives, and in this, the 124th episode of Reverse Swept Radio, Andy is going to be taking us back to a moment in October 2002, which I will confess I had totally forgotten, but comes with the rather fantastic title, Power Cricket in Cardiff.
So Shahid Afridi has absolutely hammered it. He's hammered the ball so hard that it has hit the roof of the stadium and the umpire has awarded 12 runs. Welcome to Power Cricket. The format is pretty intriguing. 30 overs a side, but split into four 15-over innings. So I guess part of the logic is that your star batsman should get two attempts each evening, each game. The highest scoring team in the first innings bats first in the second to avoid any prospect of a team winning by an innings. And you get three substitutes per innings. Now, when I first looked at the rules, I assumed that this was just a fielding thing, but rather confusingly, it applies for batting as well. What this in practice means is that you don't really have any tail enders at all. You know, you can pretty much bat a sort of full
batting. So you have a batting side and a fielding side, almost like a bit like American football.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good comparison. And in some ways you think, well, it's quite a natural, if you're trying to design a game that is all about big hitting, it's quite a natural step, isn't it? You know, why do you want the tail-enders?
Just to go back a step as well. So the highest scoring team in the first innings bats first in the second. So it's basically like Test cricket. You have Team A, Team B, Team A, Team B.
Exactly that. I guess
sorry,
the
only
just trying
to get my head around it, because when you muck around with format like this, it feels like the last man stands format that I play in, with all kinds of weird and wonderful rules that you spend days getting your head around and realize that they're actually very simple.
Yeah, well, I have to say that there's lots that is slightly mad about this format, but the actual decision of splitting the 30 overs aside into two 15-over innings, I actually rather like. It gives a bit. It gives a quite nice dynamic to the game, and gives you that sort of back and forth a little bit more like you're going to get in a test match.
And from a marketing point of view, if your big name batsman gets out for a duck in the first innings, then there's a chance that they have a chance to come back and play again.
Well, this is exactly that, and it's absolutely critical. And I think I've certainly done it, where you go to a T20 game and you've gone to see player X and they're out for a duck and you feel a little bit shortchanged. So this is slightly a way, you know, of course they might get out for two ducks, but slightly a way around that. We should, however, get to the big rule innovation here, which is the extraordinary big hit bonuses. So who needs fours and sixes? You get an eight if you hit a shot into the middle tier of the seats, a 10 for a shot into the upper tier, and a 12 for hitting the roof. And I've got the power blares through the speakers after every power hit, just in case you're not sure.
And just to clarify, all of these games played at the same ground, so hitting it into the middle tier wasn't, you know, a piddle at some grounds and impossible at other grounds.
Yeah, so the entirety of Power Cricket took place at the Millennium Stadium, or now the Principality Stadium in Cardiff. And at this point, the Millennium Stadium was only a couple of years old. It had never hosted cricket. It was really a rugby and a football stadium. They'd be quite clever, actually, and this is something that comes into when you make this consideration of putting cricket in a non-cricket ground. They'd sort of laid the pitch at an angle which just about made the boundaries kind of workable. But most significantly of all, it has a retractable roof. And this is something we've touched on before on this podcast, is a kind of thought experiment of what if you kind of abolished rain from cricket via a retractable roof. And this had it. And it's quite interesting because it makes playing cricket in the UK in the first weekend of October a viable option. Slightly amusingly, and I think this rather is in keeping with the sort of luck or lack of that Power Cricket had, It actually was a really lovely October weekend, so the benefits of the roof were rather pointless.
And presumably it meant that the ball absolutely hooped around in terms of swing bowling. You know, once you've got that roof closed, I remember it was always an issue with the rugby team that it just got massively humid in that stadium when you had a big crowd. And very little of that could actually escape.
That's a very interesting one. There's not much reporting now on the extent to which the ball swung. Because it obviously had to be a sort of, you know, drop-in. Well, it wasn't even a drop-in pitch. It was just a matting wicket laid on the pitch. You know, the bowlers certainly weren't getting much out of the pitch itself. The creators of Power Cricket were known as DP Cricket. Sarah Dunster and Philip Pride, they came from a horse racing background, and they wanted a cricket format for primetime TV. So Pride talked about, he said, viewers want fast action, incident and simplicity. There were going to be two
games.
Sounds
like a warning. It sounds like not suitable for viewers over 15 years. That's fast action, incident and simplicity.
Yes, I think it's interesting as well, isn't it? Fast action and incident. By the time you get to simplicity, you do feel you're rather sort of talking your viewers down. But there you go. There were two games between the Brits and a Rest of the World 11. I must admit, there's something that slightly grates about the Brits as a term. It just sounds a little bit underwhelming. Mm. But there you go. They obviously
a bad award ceremony. Yeah.
They couldn't call themselves England, although they were captained by then England captain Nasser Hussain, and they had a mix of England players and county stalwarts. Hussain and his fellow England team members got a fair bit of criticism for taking part. It was just 2 weeks before they were due to leave for the Ashes. And I think Hussain in particular, he made the argument, well, look, it's important that I keep practicing. But for a man who had infamously fragile fingers, you can imagine the response had he actually got injured. The Rest of the World were an altogether more serious proposition. They were captained by Stephen Fleming and were a genuinely multinational team. There's Pakistan, India, West Indies, Zimbabwe, New Zealand all represented, although interestingly no Aussies. And some seriously big names. To name just a few, we've already mentioned Shahid Afridi, but Mahela Jayawardene, Wazim Akram took part. They got some serious players for this. They got 11,000 attendees over the two games, which I think if you compared this to a county match would be a very reasonable turnout, and particularly, you know, this is a new format as well. However, this is a 73,000 capacity stadium, and it didn't look great, and obviously from an atmosphere point of view, you really, those fans are rattling around a little bit. The organisers were at pains to say how much they loved Cardiff, but they did admit it would have been easier to pull in bigger numbers in London.
Well, particularly because presumably the whole point of this format was to make money from selling tickets. So having flown in all of those people from around the world who are presumably getting big fees, the money, making the money stack up would have required a lot of people turning up. And when you've got 73,000 capacity over two games, that's 150,000. You've got 11,000 out of 150,000. My math is pretty shocking, but that looks at about 8% capacity. So anyway, it's just interesting, those moments when, you know, marketing and finance meet. Mm.
They did.
Meet cricket, and actually looking at whether it makes the money back.
Yeah, they weren't, fortunately for them, they weren't entirely dependent on that, in that they had got a deal with Sky to broadcast the two games, so that Sky obviously paid some of it. The other interesting thing on the cost, although this wasn't ever publicly confirmed, one of the journalist reports at the time suggested that players were getting something like a £3,000 fee to take part, which does give you a sense of how the game has moved on. Because the idea that you could now get some of these big international players to play two games for that sort of money is sort of a nonsense, isn't it? You know, in IPL
exactly.
Land,
now that the IPL has come along, exactly, the IPL has completely rewritten the rule book in that regard. I wonder whether for some players that might have been just interested in being part of something that was a bit of a novelty as well. You know, here's something that's a bit different in a world that wasn't completely packed. You know, it's 20 years ago, basically, a world that's not completely packed with T20 already. Why wouldn't you give something like this a bit of a go? Whereas now it's kind of, well, sure, but I can go and play IPL and do effectively the same thing for an awful lot more money and for bigger crowds.
I think that's right. And I think particularly for some of the county players, you know, what a wonderful opportunity. You know, you might not get the chance regularly to play against some of these top internationals. So as well as the innovation in the format and in the venue, there was innovation in the coverage. So several players were mic'd up and could communicate with the commentators. I guess we're increasingly familiar with this now. I guess it's particularly a feature, I think, in things like the Big Bash, and I think the IPL does quite a bit of it as well. It didn't go entirely smoothly. So wicketkeeper James Foster was nearly hurt when diving behind the stumps and landing on his battery pack. Brits batsman David Fulton was asked a question by the commentators and then promptly got out. David Lloyd, or Bumble, was happy to admit that he felt responsible. There was some comedy with this. So Dominic Cork boasted to the viewers, "Watch this one swing." Nathan Astle promptly hit him for four. I should briefly, before we conclude, recognise some of the cricket that took part. So the Rest of the World cantered to a 7-wicket win with 14 balls to spare in the first game. Courtney Walsh, the star. I mean, another very big name taking part. The second game was an altogether tighter affair. Went to the final ball, Rest of the World winning by just the two runs. Wazim Akram, again, massive name, took the Man of the Match award, although Wiley Kent Seamer, Martin Saggers, I think, could feel a little bit aggrieved given his figures of 5 for 18 off 5 overs.
That's incredible.
It's extraordinary.
When Courtney Walsh was taking 5 for 50 in the first game, 5 for 18 or 5 overs in this format is, yeah, good old Martin Savage.
I know, and against some batting lineup as well. And Ali Brown, yep, got some pride back to the Brits with a 26 ball 54. So some fun was clearly had, and there were some good performances. Crick Info reported at the time that players very much entered into the spirit of the occasion, albeit as they would a benefit or exhibition match. And I think this seems a key observation, because I think fans can tell the difference between a gimmick and the real thing, and a key part of that is the intensity with which players engage.
Yes.
This, I think, was to be the first and the last we ever saw of Power Cricket. So, next summer, the T20 Cup launches in 2003 and was an instant hit. And I think once you have that medium triumphing, it's very, very hard to see if there's, and I guess we're going to find out soon with the 100, you know, we'll find out whether there's room for another short format. There were plans for an Asia versus rest of the world event in Amsterdam, interestingly, but this was eventually cancelled due to low ticket sales and sponsorship, and Power Cricket was finally wound up formally in December 2004. I think it's very easy to mock in hindsight, and there clearly was some silliness and some madness to it. But then I think it's worth acknowledging that innovation needs its false starts. And, you know, you look at cricket history and businessmen trying to do something different with the sport, like Kerry Packer, as we acknowledge at the start of the show, have played a pretty key role in driving it forward. And it will, of course, remain the only 12 that Shahid Afridi ever hits. To the review, and for this episode, we've been watching The Test, A New Era. We'll cover the first 4 episodes today, with the next 4 in the following episode. It was released in February this year, directed by Adrian Brown. His previous pedigree involves an AFL documentary on the Western Bulldogs, released on Amazon Prime. Rocked by the sandpaper scandal, this documentary follows the Australian team as they seek to rebuild under Justin Langer and Tim Payne, and these first 4 episodes take us from the sandpaper gate up until the 2019 Test win over Sri Lanka. Toby, it's called The Test, A New Era. 4 episodes in, how much have you learnt about that new era?
Coming into this TV series, I kind of had 2 different perspectives on my mind. One person who had watched it said to me, it's all propaganda, it's going to be... This is actually an avid Australian cricket fan, said, this is all propaganda, don't believe a word of it, it's nonsense. And then separately, you had forwarded me that article from The Spectator, I think it was, saying, you'll never hate an Australian cricketer again after watching this, aren't they all great guys? To paraphrase. What I've kind of come out is kind of feeling, I suppose, a little bit of both. One of which is actually getting a bit of an appreciation of the complexity of what goes on behind the scenes to get a cricket team working again. And I think part of that is the intention of the documentary, and part of that is actually the what comes through despite possibly the best intentions of the people putting together the documentary to turn it into a bit of a propaganda exercise for Australian cricket. One thing I think was really interesting is this overarching desire, and quite understandable desire, coming out of the South African ball tampering incident, to turn the Australian cricket team not just into a cricket team that won matches, but into ambassadors that the entire Australian people could be proud of. And that is something that keeps on coming back throughout. There's this really interesting moment where they're in the dressing room, I think in Adelaide for the India series, where you see these great big boards that have been put up that say elite mateship, elite learning, elite honesty, elite cricket. And you suddenly think, wow, what kind of world is this where these players are absorbing all of these different messages?
But this is sort of the question, isn't it, though? Are they absorbing it? I mean, one of my favourite things in the documentary is watching the players as they hear kind of yet another team talk about values. And for me, it's one of the frustrations of the documentary that I just don't know if we get a real sense of how much those discussions and conversations mean. I mean, you know, when Justin Langer does his shtick that he does a few times about, you know, no abuse, but banter's fine, no abuse, but banter's fine. And I'm sort of sitting there thinking, that sounds all very well, but Do we understand where that line is? I mean, it seems like a key point of what went wrong in this squad previously was a lack of that understanding.
And it seems to be really clear in Justin Langer's head, but his ability to actually articulate that seems compromised, perhaps. And also there is this key kind of contradiction, in a way, between the mantra that is drummed into everyone that everything is about the next ball. Concentrate on the next ball. Block it out everything else. There's this constant thing about everything is white noise. People, the press talking, everything else is white noise. Concentrate on the next ball. But yet at the same time, all of these other things, which might be seen as white noise, about these broader values and what do we want to be and who are we representing, all of that is piled on the team at the same time. And certainly in these first four episodes, which we're looking at today, I think there are eight altogether, Langer seems to be is the kind of central character almost of the plot, both in terms of the behind the scenes footage that we see, but also the interviews that are done with him after the fact, talking about the games that happen and the transition that happens during this period. How does Langer come across to you?
I think he works as a lead character. He's likable, he's honest. My concern, and this is not necessarily a criticism of him as much as it is perhaps of the honesty of the film as a whole, I still don't really feel I get close to what the coach actually does, how they actually make the team better. You know, there are a couple of moments where he's kind of giving advice to players and you think, this is such obvious cliche stuff. You know, there has to be more than this. You know, there just has to be that little bit more. I think it's fascinating. Mm. There's a few of the characters in the Australian teams where I wouldn't quite get to the James Dellingpole stage of saying, you know, I kind of empathised with all of them. But Usman Khawaja, I think, comes out of this brilliantly. You know, he's interesting. All his interviews, I think, are sort of thoughtful, and he's willing to be a little bit, he's happy to challenge the status quo. And there's a fascinating moment.
He's willing to be honest.
Yeah, and he feeds back to Langer this idea that some of the team are intimidated by him. And it's fascinating because, you know that thing that managers will often do, perhaps in all organisations, where Langer's like, you know, give me feedback. And when Khawaja has the confidence to give him feedback, Langer's face is that of a man that he looks somewhat nonplussed with the honesty of the feedback, despite his protestations.
Well, and also quite staggeringly, he looks at Khawaja and says, right, who's saying this?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And Khawaja doesn't want to say, oh, it's him and him, because he feels like that would be kind of dobbing in. But Langer puts him in that really uncomfortable position. And there are other times as well where, you know, clearly Langer wants to come across as someone who's really sort of straightforward and direct, and he's the battle-hardened opening batsman who knows what it takes to win games. But I think through that, he also just comes across as someone who is difficult to connect with on a number of levels. There was quite a startling moment where Finch, in the second innings against India at Adelaide, doesn't refer his catch where it did or didn't come off his glove. And he walks, but he thinks that he felt something on his glove, but in fact his glove was on his pad and he walks. Well, doesn't refer. He's given out, doesn't refer it. And he goes back to the changing room, and Langer goes down from the kind of viewing area or whatever you call it, goes down to the coaching room and doesn't lambast Finch, but basically says to him, what the F were you doing? And Finch says kind of quite defensively, oh, look, I thought I hit it. And Langer just gives him this appalling look and walks out. And you suddenly realise this kind of pressure that's being put on people about not he wasn't bold or something, like he just got his DRS decision wrong. That kind of pressure put on the teams was, I found, really sort of startling, actually.
I guess they're very different coaching philosophies, aren't they? I mean, Langer brings the philosophy he had as a player, which was, you know, intensity, toughness. There's clearly, I mean, from accounts of Trevor Bayliss's time in charge of the England team, he was much more laid back, and I think that came with its sort of criticisms as well. I thought that non-referral incident was fascinating, partly because it showed the burden on the player at the other end. You know, the fact that Marcus Harris couldn't advise him well. I just wondered, and I don't know if there's anything in this, but I don't know if you've seen this before, perhaps at club or village cricket. I think sometimes when a batsman's in really rough form They're sometimes they just feel the world's against them, and they walk a bit quicker than they normally would and stuff. So anyway, that's a bit of cod psychology from me.
You're not desperate to be out in the middle anymore. And actually, a lot of the Australian team that we see during these first four episodes is kind of not desperate to be out in the middle. You know, go through these moments of extraordinary high, like playing against Pakistan and drawing that test, which they just celebrate as a victory, where they, you know, manage to bat out the last day and a half or whatever it is on a turning pitch in the UAE, and then at other times they just kind of barely turn up. One of the kind of pivotal series is the one against India, which Australia go on to lose 2-1. I think I'm right in saying, am I 2-1?
2-1, yeah.
Can't remember what the scoreline was. Yeah, 2-1, and then the last game against last game at the SCG is rained off with India well in front. What I thought was quite tantalising about that aspect was actually some of the insights into Kohli, which aren't really delved into because this is a series about, you know, funded by the funded by Australia, about Australian cricket. So we only see the Indian side kind of in opposition, in inverted commas, to the Australian side. But seeing the way that Kohli works and the way that they were, you know, particularly the way that Tim Payne was thinking about dealing with Kohli, you know, not engaging with him. He forbids the players from engaging with him because he says it's going to, you know, rile him up further, and he loves being in a bit of a tussle. But I thought that was a really interesting insight into what it's like as a player to be batting against someone with the kind of reputation and the skill of a Kohli.
I just think Kohli was extraordinary. I mean, in this, and it makes you realise not only is a wonderful player, but he might have the most wonderful and expressive face in global sport. I mean, so often the documentary doesn't need to do anything more than zoom in. I mean, his intensity, the emotion at all times. I mean, he's box office at all times. I'm sure other people have made this suggestion before. I think it did strike me as interesting, and possibly a nod to the not inconsiderable Indian cricket public, that, you know, when Australia play Pakistan or Sri Lanka or even England, actually, in the ODIs, there's not really any acknowledgement of the opposition in the documentary. But we get to India and suddenly Kohli has a personality, suddenly Pujara has a personality. Yep. Yep. So I don't know if, I mean, I think it was great for the film, but I also don't know if I'm being a bit of a cynic in saying I think there is a bit of a understandable sort of acknowledgement there of the Indian cricket public and their interests.
That is the first four episodes of The Test, the new Amazon Prime documentary. You do have to subscribe to Amazon Prime, which is frankly a bit of a pain, in order to watch it. We will be following up with a review of the next four episodes in the 125th episode of Reverse Swept Radio.